Hello, this is Alton Banks from the North Carolina Reading Service, previously known as the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Well, we begin as usual in our weekly readings of the Triangle Business Journal with the biz page. And under the heading of Coming Up is the article, Devils and Heels Get Together to Help Teens with Cancer. The Duke-Carolina basketball rivalry is taking a break for 2 days in August as a former player from each program lends a hand to teens battling cancer. Nolan Smith, director of basketball operations at Duke University, will host an event at Cameron Indoor Stadium on August the 26th at 11 a.m., where fans can shoot hoops with Duke and Carolina players to raise money for Teen Cancer America. Smith has hosted the fundraiser at Duke since 2016. This year, he recruited his friend, former UNC Chapel Hill star Bryce Johnson, to host an event at the Smith Center Practice Facility August 25th at 11 a.m. Among the programs supported by Teen Cancer America are efforts at the Duke Cancer Institute and at UNC's Leinberger Cancer Center to deliver specialized services for teens with cancer. And under the heading of Taking Flight comes the article, New United Club to Feature, of course, Barbecue. After a year of stealthy design work, construction, and barbecue research, the new United Club at Raleigh-Durham International Airport will open on August the 10th. It's like unwrapping a present, jokes Alex Doro, Director of Premium Services for United Airlines. I will tell you, our team in Raleigh has been very eagerly awaiting this. While new clubs have been recently unveiled in New York's LaGuardia Airport and in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, the United Club opening up the elevator in Terminal 2 is our first brand new location in terms of a brand new airport for us in over 15 years. Walk in, and the yet-to-be-revealed space has the typical feel of a United Club, complete with sleek branding, he says. And under the heading of Expanding Trend comes the article, Charlotte's Largest Food Hall Opens in Former Textile Mill. The food hall craze has a new location in Uptown Charlotte with the recent opening of Optimist Hall in a former textile mill that dates to the 1890s. It sits on an 11.9-acre parcel at 1115 North Brevard Street and has space for 19 stalls. So far, Optimist Hall has sushi, tacos, gelato, and coffee among its offerings. And under the heading of Big Picture comes the article, Apex Business Owners Look to Make Giving Back a Priority. A pair of Triangle-based business owners are set to launch their latest store and brand this fall with a focus on building community and giving back to the greater good. Megan and Kyle Dennis plan to open Mission Market in October at 124 North Salem Street in downtown Apex. The store will sell fair trade, ethically sourced specialty products ranging from clothing and accessories to home goods and gifts. Coffee, beer, and wine will also be served at the store. We had the idea to do a retail experience. It would be centered around fair trade, giving back, and sustainability, Kyle Dennis says. And under the heading of Wyndham comes the article, Spotted, Great Shot by Hadley, Great Shoes on McConnell. Biz and a buddy were traipsing around Sedgefield Country Club in Greensboro during the August 3rd, during the Wyndham Championship, and experienced a few noteworthy moments. Biz followed Raleigh native Cheeson Hadley and his pairing partner for the day, Andrew Landry. Once Landry smacked a tee shot way right and belted out his displeasure. Hadley then laced a drive right down the middle. I freaking love that shot, he quipped, especially the antithesis of what Landry said as he shot a sly grin at his pleading partner. Later, Biz spotted Sedgefield Country Club owner and McConnell Golf CEO John McConnell mixing it up with the crowd between holes and sporting some sweet on-cloud shoes. And Biz was in a great spot to see great shots from another Raleigh product, Webb Simpson, including a 12-foot birdie putt on hole number 9. Even though another North Carolina native, J.T. Poston, won, Simpson wound up taking second in the tourney on a paycheck of $669,600. And finally, on the biz page, under the heading of Hammered by the Dollar, comes the article, Businesses and Travelers Weigh Options as Pound Slumps. The British pound has shrunk so much against the dollar, it's easy to believe the pound is at its lowest point since the Battle of Yorktown. Not really, of course, but the pound at $1.21 on August the 7th is at its lowest point since reaching $1.06 in February of 1985. That has people in business and potential travelers weighing opportunities and risks. One watching closely is Rick Miner, an attorney at Womble Bond Dickinson in Raleigh, who specializes in international tax law. The firm merged with a London law firm in 2017. He sees Womble as seeing a healthy flow of work in both directions, from the United States to the United Kingdom and vice versa. The UK is still a popular place for U.S. businesses, he says, but Ireland is also popular and Germany is also trending as an attractive jurisdiction for U.S. investors. American companies moving into the United Kingdom can benefit from lower costs, while a British company coming here may be looking to generate profits in U.S. dollars. Miner says businesses generally don't make moves based on currency fluctuations because those changes are so unpredictable. But he notes that Brexit has prodded British firms to act if they have been weighing a move into the U.S. The U.K. businesses we are advising, they're not fleeing the U.K., but they're looking to expand into a friendly market like the U.S. as a hedge against the uncertainty that Brexit might bring, he says. U.S. travelers to Britain benefit, and Paul Iacono, owner of Travel Experts in Kerry, says travel to Britain is about 10% of his business. But, he says, most of our clients are pretty high-end, and while they are certainly money-conscious if they want a trip to the U.K., they're not going to be put off by a percentage point or two change in the dollar value. For our clients who are not among the big spenders, it tends to be a bucket list destination, probably the first time going, and they're going to go whether the dollar value has changed or not, price be damned. Now we turn the page to the On Technology and Startups page, and we find under the heading of Adding Capital, the article, Homegrown Coffee Brand Gets a Boost from Funder. A local beverage brand already on store shelves across the country from Publix to Whole Foods just raised its biggest equity funder yet and includes backing from an entity tied to Coca-Cola. Raleigh's Slingshot Coffee just closed a $2 million round, and CEO Janie Bonchak says it's earmarked for expansion. According to a securities disclosure, the cap on the round is $3.5 million, meaning the potential for about $1.5 million in additional financing. Altogether, eight investors participated, including longtime backer John Replegal, who confirms a venture incubator arm of Coca-Cola is also among those backing Slingshot. We have exciting plans to grow, to continue to build our team, support and grow our retail partnerships, implement greater manufacturing efficiencies, and foster our innovation pipeline, Bonchak says, noting the firm remains hyper-focused on its mission to introduce the world to its Raleigh-born products. The funder comes a year after the company opened its 13,000-square-foot cold brewery facility at Raleigh's Anchor Light Complex. Replegal, a partner at One Better Ventures in Raleigh, owns about 10% of the company. OBV advises Slingshot and owns a few percent stake, he says. Replegal says he's bullish on Slingshot for three reasons. The first being growth potential, and the second, the expanding market size of the cold brew and coffee market. Our innovation is second to none, and with Coke behind us, we should be able to inspire a generation of new consumers, he adds, as reason number three. Now, in other news on the record, IBM and I at Red Hat see potential through scale. From Red Hat CEO Jim Whitehurst to his new boss, IBM CEO Gina Rometty, the top executives from IBM and Red Hat addressed a crowd of investors on August the 2nd to talk about what happens next, now that the $34 billion deal is closed, and scale was an oft-repeated word. Whitehurst, wearing his signature white button-up shirt, said IBM already helps Red Hat get bigger deals. It's not just that IBM brings a number of people and countries in debt. It brings credibility, he explained. Our really large customers are willing to take much bigger bets on our software stack because they believe they have IBM behind them. When asked how to best realize revenue synergies from the deal, Arvind Krishna, Senior Vice President of Cloud and Cognitive Software at IBM, said it comes down to the company's ability to scale Red Hat in the near term. Near-term scaling Red Hat and getting Red Hat more into our big clients, more into the countries where we have scale, Krishna said on the investor panel. There's a massive ecosystem that we bring that can help. Remedy said to expect sales calls to be more experiential as the teams take advantage of the 75 IBM garages across its network. Red Hat already has this strategy, she said, but by an IBM garage, a solution to a client's problem can be scaled across an entire organization, something Red Hat might have trouble doing on its own, she said. When you go to big clients to scale, this would eat up Red Hat, Romiti said. And under the heading of hiring comes the article, Amazon looks for leaders as it grows in the triangle. While the massive distribution hub in Garner may be months away from opening, a similar facility in Charlotte, complete with high-tech robotics, is up and running, giving the triangle an idea of what's coming. Jeremy Stewart, general manager and site leader for Amazon's Charlotte hub, says he's looking for the same things the yet-to-be-hired general manager in Garner will be looking for, and it's not just 1,500 employees with resumes. Stewart says he's looking for the next set of leaders for Amazon. For us in Charlotte, and it would be the same in Raleigh, we're looking for people who want to work hard. We're working for people who want to make history and people who want to have fun, he says. But he's also looking for people who want to grow with a company, future leaders. His top job interview question, what do you want to be in 3 years? It gives him an insight into an employee's ambition. And ambition is exactly what Amazon is looking for, he says. Jobs are available across the board from finance to human resources. The Garner facility is being built at a site on Jones Sausage Road and is expected to create 1,500 jobs, a $200 million, four-story, 2.6 million square foot investment expected to open in 2020. And under the heading of Big for Durham comes the article, Cree's Wolfspeed lands a new $85 million deal. As Durham-based Cree shifts its focus to next-generation semiconductors, it has inked another deal analysts are celebrating. Cree and ON Semiconductor Corp. announced Cree will produce and supply Wolfspeed silicon carbide wafers to ON. That's O-N. The deal is valued at more than $85 million, according to the company. In May, Cree announced it would spend up to $1 billion in new Wolfspeed investments. The goal is to expand silicon carbide capacity by developing a materials megafactory in Durham. Angelo Zeno, a senior analyst with CFRA Research, says, overall, Cree's Wolfspeed business continues to gain traction, and I think what you want to see is for them to continue to add long-term partners, which add visibility to them and allows them to expand and grow capacity for that side of the business. Next, we turn to the healthcare and education page of this week's Triangle Business Journal, and under the heading of Uncertain Future comes the article, New Hanover Hospital Could Go Up for Sale. The state's largest county-owned hospital could be on the auction block next month as the consolidation in the healthcare industry continues. In July, New Hanover Board of Commissioners announced it was considering the sale of the county's hospital system, New Hanover Regional Medical Center, known by the acronym of NHRMC. The board will meet in early September to consider a resolution to explore partnerships. The Wilmington Hospital serves 40,000 patients per year. NHRMC also has facilities throughout New Hanover, Brunswick, and Pender counties, as well as in Jacksonville and Whiteville. Its physician group visits were reported at 618,750 in 2018. Though owned by the county, the hospital receives no county tax dollars and is entirely independent. It's the third largest county-owned hospital in the U.S. John Gizdik, the system's president and CEO, says NHRMC is stable, but the future uncertainty of the healthcare industry makes it smart to explore options from a position of strength. It isn't going to get any easier in healthcare, he says. More likely, it will get more difficult as we move forward. According to its most recent annual financial report, the hospital saw just over $1 billion in net patient service revenue in 2018, up from $944.4 million in 2017. Its operating expenses totaled $958 million, also up from the $887 million in 2017. In total, revenue increased 6.9% in 2018, while expenses increased 8%. Gizdik says a myriad of factors led to consideration of a sale. One is the projected population increase of its region, which he says will double within 15 years. That puts the hospital in a position where it needs investments to maintain high-quality care for so many new patients. He estimates investments may need to be north of $1 billion to ensure quality care in the near future. And under the heading of impasse comes the article, UNC Health Calls for Mediation in Battle Over Health Plan. Following another failed attempt at reconciling differences between State Treasurer Dale Folwell and North Carolina's largest health systems, UNC Healthcare's leadership has called for a mediator to resolve the dispute. On August the 5th, UNC health leaders and Folwell met to no success on Folwell's clear pricing project for the state health plan. Afterward, Charles Owen, the UNC Healthcare Board of Directors chairman, sent a letter to Folwell and state health plan leadership affirming the system's opposition to the plan. The letter, obtained by Triangle Business Journal, claims UNC Health met in good faith and remains resolved to making sure this happens. Folwell later derided the system and said it was in favor of secret contracts and higher costs. But Owen's letter also suggested the retention of a mediator to resolve the dispute. "We stand ready to do this as soon as possible and hope you will consider this approach," he wrote. Officials with the Folwell's office did not immediately respond to comment. At risk is the access to the state's largest hospital system for nearly 727,000 state employees, retirees, and beneficiaries who would face out-of-network charges in the revised plan if no agreement is met. On August the 7th, UNC Health CEO Wesley Burks emailed employees, "The leadership of UNC Healthcare is deeply committed to finding a resolution to this dispute because it affects all of us. Our state employee colleagues face a loss of access to high-quality care and coverage. That makes this personal." The email also touted the counterproposal UNC Health has presented to the treasurer, one that relies on a transition to value-based care, which has been heralded by the state's largest insurers and systems in recent months. "You've dedicated your careers to serving the health needs of others, so you know how critical it is to preserve and protect access to quality health care," Burks told employees. Burks said UNC is eager to sit with SHP leadership and believes facilitated discussion can create a win-win scenario for everyone, but most importantly, our valued state employees. And also on the healthcare page under the heading of Beyond Japan comes the article, "Raleigh CRO Looks to Expand in Asian Markets." A triangle-based contract research organization called a CRO says Asian Pacific markets present a massive opportunity for expansion, potentially adding to its already double-digit growth. According to CEO Colin Shannon, Raleigh-based PRA Health Sciences saw more than $670 million in new business awards in the second quarter of this year. Year over year, the company reported a 14% growth. Now the company is making an even heavier investment in Asia. At the end of May, PRA finished its buyout of a joint venture it held with Takeda Pharmaceutical based in Tokyo. The venture began in 2017, pairing together Takeda drug development experts with PRA's research expertise. The buyout now gives PRA a permanent outpost in the region with 450 employees in Japan. Many of those are former Takeda employees, which Shannon says made an attractive prospect for the deal. A lot of them have transitioned over from Takeda, so they've really got a lot of really strong drug development experience, he told analysts in early August. We've a great opportunity for them to leverage that in Japan, and we'll be looking for building that out in the next number of quarters. Next, we turn to the real estate page of this week's Triangle Business Journal and find the article, New North Hills Tower to be Tallest on Beltline. The hits keep on coming for commercial real estate in Raleigh. Construction is scheduled to begin next year on North Hills' latest high-rise by Kane Realty, and plans call for the building to be the tallest along Raleigh's Beltline. Dubbed Walter Tower, the proposed 35-story mixed-use building will feature 33 floors of luxury apartments and amenities with 6,500 square feet reserved for retail space. Walter Tower will total 570,000 square feet and be situated at 4,000 Front at North Hill Street near the intersection with Six Forks Road. Residents will have their pick of 376 luxury apartments, including 21 penthouses, as well as amenities such as a pool on the sixth floor, a courtyard with adjacent wellness center, and a rooftop courtyard and club room. The Walter is designed by SRSSA, Smallwoods, Reynolds, Stewart, Stewart & Associates, and will feature a glass design to offer an expansive view of the Raleigh skyline. North Hills has seen massive development and investment over the years, recently turning heads after the Kane Realty's Tower 4 broke the long-awaited $40 per square foot rental rate barrier with an asking rate of $41.50 per square foot. And CapTrust Tower just sold for a record $458 per square foot. And under the heading of second quarter comes the article, Triangle Industrial Space Sees One Trend Continue and Another Change. A second quarter report on industrial space in the Triangle shows one trend continued while another reversed course. Industrial space continued to see dropping vacancy rates, while warehouse rents rebounded following four quarters of decline, according to Colliers International's latest report. The report says the area continues to remain an attractive investment for tenants in need of industrial space, as numerous companies have announced plans to expand into the area. Rental rates rose in the second quarter, with warehouse space seeing a 28-cent bump to $6.28 per square foot, and flex space enjoying a 27-cent increase to $11.80 per square foot. Warehouse rates had been declining since 2018 to a low of $6 per square foot earlier this year. Meanwhile, vacancy rates in both flex and warehouse space continue to fall, with warehouse vacancies dipping to 2.49%. and flex space dropping to 8.2%. This comes after warehouse vacancy rates rose at the start of the year, following the delivery of new industrial space. Vacancy rates are now below 2018 levels. And finally, on the real estate page, under the heading Downtown Raleigh, comes the article, Plans to Tail First Phase of $250 Million Seaboard Project. The site of a squat, single-story cafe and catering shop will soon be the first phase of a major redevelopment near the heart of Raleigh. Washington, D.C.-based P.N. Hoffman has submitted plans to transform Seaboard Station, currently an acre of mostly parking spaces and greenery along West P Street, into a seven-story mixed-use development, complete with hotel, residential, and retail space. Plans filed in May call for 311,400 square feet of mixed-use space with 96 apartments, 150 hotel rooms, and around 10,300 square feet of restaurant and retail space. The N-shaped structure will be split between apartment and hotel uses with a shared amenities area in the middle. P.N. Hoffman plans to provide 236 parking spaces in an integrated subsurface parking deck. The company bought the 7 acres that make up Seaboard Station from William Peace University last year with plans for a $250 million redevelopment project. Company officials say they have a multi-phase plan to grow the size of the shopping center from less than 100,000 square feet to 800,000 square feet. In total, the redevelopment plans could bring approximately 650 apartments, 150 hotel rooms, and 90,000 square feet of new retail space. The project involves demolishing some of the existing retail buildings while keeping others, P.N. Hoffman CEO Monty Hoffman said last year. The location is superb, Hoffman said. We love the composition of uses that we can put on here. We're really a neighborhood transformation type developer. Next, we turn the page and find the On Business page of this week's TBJ. And under the heading of Past Decade, we find the article, Study Details North Carolina's Fastest Growing Jobs. A new study found careers in North Carolina's business sector saw the fastest rate of growth during the last decade. Across the nation, jobs in business and healthcare industries saw the most growth, according to the study from CommercialCafe.com. In North Carolina, the fastest growing occupation was financial examiners, going from just 680 jobs statewide in 2009 to more than 4,000 in 2018. A nearly 500% increase. As described by the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics, financial examiners with a median salary of around $80,000 ensure compliance with laws governing financial institutions and transactions. North Carolina, with a population above 10.3 million, has one of the fastest growing economies in the U.S. and an unemployment rate around 4.5%. In 2018, 35% of the state's workforce, that's 1.5 million people, were employed in the business sector, the study found, compared to 6% in education and nearly 14% in healthcare. Industrial occupations accounted for 20.5% of the workforce. The study used data from the BLS and excluded occupations with less than 500 positions in the state and 5,000 across the country. Nationally, financial examiner jobs increased by 125%, the third best rate in the country. The fastest growing job sector was personal care aides in the healthcare industry with 251% growth. More than 2 million people work in the occupation, driven in large part by an aging population. In second place was market specialists at 182%. Rounding out the top five were engineers and architects, 115%, followed by event planners, 114%. Other highlights, in 2018, North Carolina had 4.3 million employees overall, and roughly one-third of all jobs are concentrated in four states, California, New York, Texas, and Florida. Now we reach this week's cover story, and it's entitled, After 3 years of hits from hurricanes, lawsuits, bankruptcies, layoffs shroud countless businesses. This article is filled with sidebars and bar charts, and I'll try to convey some of those to you. Lloyd Coppage remembers the drive through slushy grass and muddy puddles. Roads were closed. Power was out of stoplights as he meandered a new route, cell phone in hand. Before his knee-high galoshes hit the saturated dirt, he knew it was bad. Already, maintenance employees who had made it to the plant in Lumberton reported debris and pooled water. But Coppage, a self-described turnaround guy in the manufacturing industry for more than five decades, thought he'd seen worse. He had bought out Alamac a decade ago with an investor group, and it was the latest in a string of successful flips. One of his past companies, Wolverine Brass, was on the South Carolina coast when Hugo ripped through, and it recovered just fine. I've seen hurricanes, he says. But Hurricane Matthew in 2016 was different. An October the 8th superstorm of wind and rain, followed by unprecedented flooding. Over the months that followed, Alamac Investors, which had acquired Lumberton's Alamac American Knits plant in 2015, drowned in those waters. But the company wasn't alone. A slew of litigation, bankruptcy filings, and grant applications detailed an unprecedented need from businesses big and small slammed by Matthew, and often again by Florence in 2018. And with hurricane season approaching, those whose businesses remain have their eyes on the skies, hoping that the next storm won't be the death blow. Public documents presented to the North Carolina General Assembly show that even for small business owners who qualify for recovery loans, the dollars are slow to funnel from government coffers, as just 3% of the federal allotment for the storm 3 years ago had been handed out. There are several funds targeted towards storm relief, such as the Community Development Block Grant Program, a federally funded pool that includes earmarks for small business recovery. But a recent report out of the Program Evaluation Division claims mismanagement and ineptitude are preventing the dollars from getting to businesses in North Carolina. As of December, more than 2 years after the storm hit, North Carolina had spent just 1%, or $3.4 million, of the $236.5 million allotted for recovery. The report presented to the General Assembly in May shows that non-compliant contracts even resulted in North Carolina spending $3.7 million unnecessarily. The state's working as hard as we can to provide those funds, but we have to follow all the rules and regulations, insists George Sherrill, Chief of Staff of the North Carolina Department of Commerce. That includes a lot of environmental review assessments, so I think you'll see that process pick up quickly here now that we've got some of those regulatory permits out of the way. Of the $360 million in state-appropriated disaster relief, nearly half at $160 million had been spent as of June. The report recommended that mechanisms be established to ensure contracts are compliant and that state officials work to develop standardized performance metrics. In the meantime, state officials admit they're frustrated with the process. Governor Roy Cooper went to Washington, D.C. in July to lobby for faster fund delivery, as $0 had been delivered targeted toward Hurricane Florence. On August the 2nd, nearly a year after the storm, the Federal Department of Housing and Urban Development finally announced the upcoming Federal Register for $168 million in hurricane recovery mitigation funds for North Carolina. That's as Congress had passed the mitigation funding back in February of 2018. When published, the Federal Register will direct North Carolina on what kinds of projects are eligible, and the state can actually start the federally mandated process to access those funds. The state is still awaiting federal registers for all Community Development Block Grant disaster recovery funds associated with Hurricane Florence. Cooper, through a spokesman, declined an interview for this story. For companies, relief can't come fast enough, as many saw a double hit, notes Jonathan Brereton, an executive director of Thread Capital, initiative of the North Carolina Rural Center. The combination of Matthew and Florence, relatively close together, and hitting a lot of the same areas was, I'm sure for some businesses, basically a death knell, he said. Much of what Brereton sees come down to insurance coverage, he says. If they don't have the right insurance coverage, they are unable to recoup the losses. Then they have to take on debt, which can be difficult, he says. That's what happened with Porter's Neck Country Club in Wilmington, which claimed that when its insurance policy failed to pay out what it thought it was owed after Florence, it had to take on additional debt, putting it in dire financial straits. In the suit, which settled in June, Porter's Neck claimed to have sustained $7.5 million in losses, including $6 million it claimed should have been covered. But in its own response, insurance firm Allied World Assurance Company pointed to an unambiguous, enforceable, and applicable flood exclusion. The insurance firm, sued by Alamac in May, claimed a similar defense. A review of litigation shows insurers don't back down quickly. Spirit Aerosystems, for example, sued in early 2017 over its purported Hurricane Matthew losses in Kinston. It claimed a group of insurers should compensate it for $33 million in production delays caused by the storm, a claim disputed by the firms in their own court filings. According to executive statements on earnings calls, Spirit had to airship massive airline parts to meet contracts on time after storm delays and took months to catch up. The litigation wasn't settled until January of 2019. NC Department of Insurance Commissioner Mike Causey says that can be typical. For some without spirits girth, including Alamac, it's too late for a company to overcome its losses by the time a settlement is reached. Both Causey and Brereton said it's important to understand the ins and outs of a policy before the storm hits, and not in a costly courtroom where, even if a resolution is found, it can take months. Not all companies can survive long enough to wait for a verdict. Brereton also says he's run into businesses where, after Matthew, an insurance firm paid out, then dumped them. It's a tough circumstance, he says. Causey says that even when a claim is viewed as legitimate by an insurance company, it can take months to get a payout. He casts part of the blame on fraudulent claims. Sometimes people think insurance companies are picking on them when they ask all those questions. But when you've got 1 out of 10 insurance claims that are submitted are fraudulent claims, the companies have to do what they have to do, he says. For Florence alone, total claims were about $4.3 billion. As of July, that was made up of nearly 349,000 claims from a combination of businesses and individuals. Of those, nearly 82,000 had been closed without payment, which includes those deemed to be fraudulent. Insurers had already closed more than 233,000 of those claims. But that's 34,000 with claims still pending, Causey says. If people have problems, if you've got delays, contact our office because we're here to help. We are helping. We've helped thousands of people from our offices get their claims in a timely manner. In the meantime, it's not uncommon for business owners to take on debt to keep their doors open, Brereton says. But he says traditional debt can be tough to take on after a storm. Certainly, the business revenues may have taken a hit, Brereton says. It's very difficult for a traditional lender. That's where entities such as the Rural Center come in. Its Golden Leaf-funded Thread Capital Program lends money through two programs, Standard Small Business Lending and Disaster Recovery Lending. In 2018, its first year, the company distributed 135 loans, the vast majority being in disaster recovery. Its disaster lending initiatives included expedited rapid recovery bridge loans of up to $50,000 to stabilize a business via cleanup costs and lost revenue. For Florence, Thread put out 71 of these loans, averaging nearly $34,000 each. And its resilient recovery loans are worth up to $250,000, earmarked for repairing physical damage and recouping from more significant economic losses. To date, it's distributed 25 of these, averaging nearly $76,000 per loan. But the loans stretch out over a decade. If there's another storm in 2 years, that can saddle a company with debt, Brereton notes, and the fear is that they may not be able to get a second recovery loan. Rural Center President Patrick Woody said he recently ran into a firm that had, in the past few months, just completed payments on making their Hurricane Floyd recovery loan. Those seeking Thread loans are typically already out of traditional debt options, having failed to access SBA financing. And Woody and Brereton worry about what additional debt will mean for future storm recovery. Our mindset shifted from Matthew to Florence, Brereton says. After Matthew, we thought this was a once-in-20-year storm. After Florence, well, now we're preparing for every 2 or 3 years. There's a high degree of concern, Woody adds. There's a big focus on trying to build in more resilient ways so that impacts from future storms can be minimized. After Matthew, the office worked with about 20 different businesses. After Florence, it was 150, and it's already made loans to more than 90 of those firms. Commercial Cheryl says that on the small business recovery front, his team has processed and approved 31 loans for $3.7 million. If companies satisfy certain terms, the loans can be forgiven in 3 years. But they, too, are vetted, like any loan a bank would make. and that means he shares concerns that loans may not be paid off before the next storm hits, possibly leaving a business owner ineligible for additional support. Already, he's seeing multiple companies stack up assistance applications. On July 2nd, Commerce processed and approved its most recent loan for a Fayetteville company called GreenBiz, a plant nursery that reported heavy damage from both Matthew and Florence. He fears another storm could prove a final straw for many of the companies the state has assisted so far. Other assistance is available through Commerce programs, such as the Division of Employment Security Initiative, that can pay benefits to workers out of work because of the storm. Payments after both Matthew and Florence were made to employees in a variety of sectors, from farmers to loggers. DES has paid out more than 8,000 claims, totaling about $6.3 million. The goal isn't just to recoup employees, but to keep them in town, Cheryl says, so when that small business comes back online, those employees are there. We want people to have jobs, because if those people don't have jobs in these communities, the communities go away, he says. The tax base is going to leave, so we want to get these storm-impacted communities back up and running. State officials admit the needs are increasing. It's the subject of Cooper's Executive Order 80, which created a Climate Change Council, Cheryl says. Since January, it has met regularly to talk about issues like storm resiliency. But Brereton, Cheryl, and Causey agree on one storm prep detail: flood insurance. It was sad to see so many people lose everything and get flooded, Causey says, of the 2018 storms. What made it really sad is that the large percentage of these people had no flood insurance. That was shocking to me. Out of a state with nearly 10.5 million people, less than 135,000 families or businesses had flood insurance in 2018, according to NCDOI. You need to realize, wherever you live, if it rains where you live, you need flood insurance, Causey says. You can't wait until there's a named storm. There's a 30-day waiting period. His advice to homeowners and business owners are like, make sure you have three kinds of policies: wind coverage, flood coverage, and a traditional homeowners or business policy. For businesses trounced in the 2018 storm, the advice comes too late. Firms currently undergoing litigation to recover or recoup from storm losses vary, from a church in Lumberton to a barbershop down the street to a plethora of farmers. Attorneys say it comes down to how long they can hold out. It's pretty bad, says attorney Danny Bradford, who has represented several business owners evaluating their own options for storm recovery, from loans to bankruptcy petitions. Just yesterday, I was sending out information for SBA loans to rebuild and repair. He says information on programs that actually are available to his clients isn't always reaching them in time. That was the case with an auto repair shop, which saw significant flooding. By the time he discovered help was available, Bradford says, he couldn't afford to cash flow the repairs necessary to fully rebuild. He adds, by the time he got around to getting some relief, he got around to nearly double the damage, rot, and mold issues. It's similar to how Coppedge describes the fall of Alamac, albeit on a much smaller scale. At Alamac, court filings from an insurance dispute describe a torn-off roof, which allowed water to leach in and ruin sensitive electronics over a span of months. Coppedge says the remnants of that roof scattered across the 400,000-square-foot plant, shearing through the walls. And outside, the water kept rising as Lumberton experienced what, at the time, was believed to be a once-in-a-lifetime flood. It took forever to get the roof fixed, he said, of the months, not days, that followed. We'd turn around and there would be water leaking into some electronics. We were doing the best we could, but that hurricane put us out of business. After funneling $5.5 million into Alamac, management notified its employees they would be shuttering the doors, a conversation Coppedge remembers in fevered detail. I told them I was sorry, because I had promised them we were going to win, he says. I told them I had never lost. For Coppedge, a 50% owner of Alamac, it's his biggest business regret. Just prior to Alamac, the turnaround was coming, he insists. Customers were starting to trust the textile brand, and contracts were starting to be won again. And then Matthew tore off the roof. Coppedge fought. When water ruined the electronic dye mixer, he directed employees to mix by hand. When water pooled in, he had them mop it out. But the leaking continued, causing more machine blowouts. Customer orders were delayed, and over the weeks, they started looking for other vendors. The insurance company wouldn't pay what he thought Alamac was due. A layoff disclosure was filed with the state of North Carolina, and the last remaining assets were sold off for about $3 million to a British firm that, so far, has paid out just $1 million and hired just a fraction of those who worked in the textile plant. I never have found one until now that I couldn't turn around, he says. I wanted to save those 187 jobs, but we didn't have a chance. Next, we turn to the small business page of the week's Triangle Business Journal, and we find the article by Jim Lee entitled, Family Businesses Should Coordinate Long-Term Plans. Every now and again, I ascend to my pulpit to preach the benefits of the five plans that all family businesses should develop, implement, and keep current. The business plan, the strategic plan, the succession plan, the estate plan, and the disengagement plan. And if basic planning is essential to the good health of family businesses, then coordinated planning can produce rosy-cheeked good health. Instead of working on them independently, consider linking the planning processes. Link succession planning with estate planning. Together, these two plans lock in preferences and controls for the future distribution and use of assets and the operation of the business. Link strategic planning with succession planning. Under the best of circumstances, succession is a subset of comprehensive family and business strategies. The family and business strategy ties together the two so that strategic decisions for the business and those for the family support one another. Link the business plan with the strategic plan. A plan should include an outline of the company's anticipated strategy and feed directly into it. As the strategic plan evolves with time and changing circumstances, the business plan should be updated too. Then coordinate the disengagement plan, the strategic plan, and the succession plan. The disengagement, that is, leaving the business voluntarily or otherwise, of one or more key family members can affect succession and has as much impact on strategy as does any other major change in the company's operating condition. Tying these plans together can facilitate many nights of uninterrupted sleep for business owners. I'm not an estate planning specialist, but here's what I've observed to be the advantages of coordinating estate planning with succession planning. Both planning processes should start with analysis, the current status of the business for succession planning, and of family and personal assets for estate planning. If the analyses are coordinated, the findings create a composite picture of family holdings that are subject to future distribution, use, and management. The next step in a coordinated planning process is identifying the long-term needs and preferences of the business, the current senior owner or executive, and the family. Setting goals and plotting strategies for achieving them are steps 3 and 4. The fifth planning step, selection of tools and tactics, also applies both to estate planning and to succession planning. If the two are approached in a coordinated fashion, choices of advisors and managers and of methods for ownership transfer and estate protection can be made with confidence. The final step, evaluation of results by those who made the plan, is admittedly easier for a succession plan than for an estate plan. You can monitor the progress of succession transition firsthand, but you can't count on being around to monitor the effects of your estate plan firsthand. Next, we turn to this week's Viewpoint page, and the guest column this week is written by Merrick Gutman. He's a non-resident senior fellow at the Washington, D.C.-based Brookings, and his article is entitled, Cities and Region Must Stay the Global Course. The tallest office building in Wichita, Kansas is only 22 stories. Metro Syracuse, New York's population, is barely 650,000 people. The Des Moines, Iowa airport has one direct international flight. San Antonio is not headquarters to a major multinational bank. 38 U.S. companies generate more revenue than Louisville, Kentucky's entire annual gross metropolitan product. These places are not ranked on any list of international influence alongside London, New York, Tokyo, or Paris. And yet, they're global cities, anchoring global metropolitan economies. Their leaders have embraced strategic international engagement to ensure their regional futures. They challenge the premise that being global belongs to economic giants, infrastructure gateways, financial services hubs, and cultural arbiters with legacy visibility. Seizing this mantle remains an urgent task for cities in an increasingly complex, interconnected web of global value chains. Continued urbanization created new international competition for mid-sized metro areas like the Research Triangle. Rapid technological change enabled extreme mobility of talent, invention, and investment. At the same time, the gravitational pull of elite innovation assets and tech-force workforce has increased the concentration of economic strength among fewer superstar metro areas. In order to compete, city regions are rediscovering that their historic foundations for economic prosperity are as centers of global trade, not coffee shops. The evidence is clear that greater exports and foreign investment are beneficial to firms, workers, and metro economies. They accelerate job creation, raise wages, inject innovation, and increase resiliency. Every region can and must be global in its orientation to take advantage of these trends rather than to be taken advantage of. A proactive metro strategy to strengthen international economic connections and competitiveness is needed. As one example, over about 8 years, cross-sector coalitions in more than 30 diverse U.S. and international cities have taken this action through research, problem-solving, and peer networking under the Global Cities Initiative. These metro areas began to redefine their position in the global economy, from increasing exporting firms to managing foreign investment, investing in infrastructure connectivity to cultivating and welcoming talent, establishing metro economic partnerships to projecting a distinctive identity in the global marketplace. In doing so, they helped unwind a narrative tying globalization solely to plant closings and foreign outsourcing, instead elevating the possible benefits of growth, innovation, and exchange. Now this progress is being tested by tariffs and trade wars. Hopes to sign agreements with European and Pacific Rim countries have given way to uncertainty and escalating rhetoric. Economists estimate the impact of the new federal trade policy cost $7.8 billion in GDP and a double-digit decline in targeted U.S. exports last year. Firms and cities are questioning the value of staying this course, but despite these headwinds, metro areas must remain committed to sustain global engagement. Cross-border flows of goods, services, and capital currently form almost 40% of all global GDP, demonstrate the reality that globalization is not going to simply reverse, despite current politics. To compete and grow, history proves that city regions must stay focused on their global fluency for the long term. By centering on their global position, this new breed of global cities have spurred innovations that will help navigate through any economic squall, international or domestic. They integrated global activity with mainstream economic development efforts. They discovered opportunity in paying more attention to growth of middle market firms and the aftercare of mergers and acquisitions. They created novel tools to identify target markets and collaborate with global counterparts for mutual benefit. And they found new ways to better define and communicate what makes them unique and valuable to international audiences. Compared to other mid-sized U.S. regions, the Research Triangle is very lucky to already have been a recognizable global brand, as well as distinctively globally competitive assets and specializations. And yet, there is untapped potential. The question is whether the region could build on its foundation with expanded strategies and new collaborations to maximize its global engagement for sustainable, inclusive economic growth. From Raleigh to Rotterdam, emerging global cities possess diverse traits, governance structures, and socioeconomic realities. A commitment to international engagement and pioneering practices for global fluency must be their North Star for economic success. This week's editor's notebook is entitled J.P. Morgan's Entry Could Change Banking Landscape. If history is any indication, J.P. Morgan Chase & Company CEO Jamie Dimon will ask his lieutenants to go full force in bagging as many deposit accounts as they can in the first 18 months. Dimon is jumping on the opportunity to enter some of the fastest-growing markets in North America, which also happens to be Bank of America, Wells Fargo, and Legacy BB&T's territory. Early last year, Dimon envisioned opening 400 new retail branches and hiring an additional 3,000 people in 20 new markets. Interestingly, Bank of America has the same robust plan of adding 400 retail branches in new and existing markets. From his pep talk in Chapel Hill on August the 7th, it looks like Diamond's drive is well underway, with fast-growing cities such as Raleigh, Charlotte, and Nashville, Tennessee in its crosshairs. Bank executives at B of A, Wells, and Truist, that's the new name after BB&T and SunTrust merge, will have to protect their largest clients. For a while, they'll be forced to play defense. But J.B. Morgan's entry actually would be good for businesses needing loans, investment instruments, and a diversified portfolio. Additional compensation will breed better deals, better customer service, and eventually will force the weak to perish. For the most part, the larger banks, at least in the Triangle, paid little attention to what the community banks were doing. Going by the local deposit market share, it's clear that, understandably, the Triangle banking environment operated in two tiers over the past decade, the big banks and the community banks, and there was minimal movement in terms of year-over-year market share. J.P. Morgan's push for deposits through its retail and private wealth connections is unlikely to affect community banks at first. JPM is targeting the big fish, and it is very good when it comes to street fights for clients. In June, in front of hundreds of bank employees present at the opening of the bank's new Midtown Manhattan branch, Diamond exclaimed, "We're going right at Bank of America folks in Charlotte, their hometown." With all this going on, the bank that's most vulnerable to losing customers is Truist. Anytime there's a merger of such proportions, operational challenges clash against a customer's needs. If Truist wants to avoid customer leakage, it has to put in an additional focus to meet every need from the legacy BB&T and SunTrust clients. If you're a business and you have a banking relationship in town, this is a good development. J.P. Morgan's interest will make everyone sharp. Well, that music means we've run out of time for today's episode of the Triangle Business Journal. I hope you enjoyed it. Be sure to listen next time. I'm Alton Banks, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. So long till next time.